Good morning. Well, this morning we are honored to be joined by Ravi Jain, who is an immigration lawyer in Canada, and he has quite an exciting background because he's the past co-president of the Canadian Immigration Lawyers Association. He's the past chair of Canadian Bar Association for the immigration law section, the lawyer of the year for Best Lawyers and Immigration Law 2022, and he's a certified specialist of the Law Society of Ontario, and he's also can talk about immigration in the United States. It's really a real joy to have you with us because everybody in real estate talks about two things, interest rates and immigration. So welcome.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Now, you know, the biggest thing, I'll dive right into it, is Canadian real estate ownership. Can that ownership in Canada facilitate permanent residency or citizenship?
Not so much. And that's called the passive investment, right? So there are schemes around the world where you buy real estate and you get, you know, a golden visa. Yeah. Canada is not one of them. The federal investor program and Quebec investor program, you know, even those programs prevented that. Of course, the federal investor program no longer exists. The Quebec investor program has been criticized as being a program that's just about facilitating people getting into the country and not a lot of benefit to Canada. Sometimes the spouse and kids are here and they're using taxpayer resources. And then the main applicant goes back home, and that's sort of the criticism. But, you know, we might consider the fact that I think in this country, we're competing for entrepreneurs, investors, you know, with respect to other countries, number one. Number two, when people like that do come to Canada, they may buy homes. They may fill those homes with all kinds of furniture and other products. And so there is an economic benefit. And in any event, many of them are serial entrepreneurs and they'll start something. And if it fails, they'll continue on. And many of them, many immigrants, as we know, create wonderful companies that employ many Canadians. So I don't think we want to turn our back on investors and entrepreneurs simply because of this concern that, you know, they're just buying their way into Canada. There are ways we can prevent that, and we can ensure that there is a net gain to Canada. It just takes some smart policy.
Well, it's also a big question, you know, how exactly has the investor migration affected the housing market? You know, the statistics are really unclear, and there's so many different kind of investors, from students to that maybe their parents buy them a house to all of the various issues that you mentioned. I know that in Spain and Portugal, the golden visa has attracted tons of people. All you did was buy real estate. And we had a little bit of that, as you mentioned earlier. We had that, you know, 10 years ago or so, where, you know, the government forced the investor to buy some obscure motel corporation or something. And that would then, eventually they would get their money back and no interest. But that's all changed dramatically. So how affected is the housing market by immigration?
Well, I mean, that's a loaded question. It's tough to say. I mean, we had, you know, for years, particularly the Liberals, you know, and the Prime Minister, they would go on, the ministers of immigration would go on and on about the benefit to Canada. They would talk about a low birth rate and aging population. I myself started to write articles saying, look, it's not an aging population anymore, it's an aged population. And that was confirmed by Statistics Canada. So I would, you know, cite those stats, and I would say, look, we are an aged population and we do need people coming in. All labor force growth was coming from immigration, all those standard lines. Then what happened is that the number of permanent residents, you know, was hovering around 1%, just under 1% for many years, and then just a little bit over 1%. Now we're talking about 485,000 and 500,000 this year, permanent residents. And Minister Miller has indicated he's going to keep that at 500,000 next year. So that's pretty flat. And like I say, hovering around 1% is not a big deal. That's certainly not affecting anything. The issue is that the number of temporary residents, so people on work permits and student visas, has gone through the roof. I mean, we're talking, there's 2.7 million floating around right now.
Jesus.
So, yeah. I mean, and this is where the ministers are saying, well, you know, this is a real problem. We have the prime minister saying the numbers have gotten out of control. So a lot of, you know, editorialists and others are saying it's almost like they don't, you know, it's almost like they're trying to find out who created this problem. When, you know, when of course they were the, you know, there was the prime minister and there were the ministers, the housing minister, was the former immigration minister. So a lot of people are making those cheeky comments saying, you guys are the ones that were driving the ship. How come you didn't recognize it? The Minister of Immigration, I think, did a fairly credible job explaining that, look, there was COVID. We had a double cohort year in terms of students where students were waiting. And then all of a sudden we had the two cohorts coming at once. That wasn't anticipated, I guess. You know, we could sort of maybe run that argument, but to be honest with you, they were getting reports of the dramatic increase in temporary residents, students, sure, and workers. And people like me were writing editorials saying, listen, there's a real impact on some international students. Some of them are committing suicide. Some of them are getting lied to by immigration consultants who are telling them that they have a guaranteed pathway to immigration. Yeah. Some immigration consultants are steering them to colleges where they get a fat commission. Some are steering them to private colleges where they didn't even qualify for a postgraduate work permit afterwards. So I've seen a lot of victims, and I think that the government's been asleep at the wheel when it comes to regulating the profession, because I think it comes down to who's giving the advice. And if there's lawyers and their licenses on the line, you're going to get more ethical advice, in my view. And I've testified in Parliament with respect to that view, because as I say, I've just seen too many victims now. So part of it is they didn't regulate the people giving the advice. Part of it is that the federal government just said, hey, it's not our responsibility. We issue the visas, sure, but the provinces control education and they're the ones admitting all these people and we're just rubber stamping. Well, number one, don't rubber stamp it if you see them going out of control. And number two, get tough with the provinces, which they finally have done now, and they've made the provinces choose, because the provinces need an attestation letter now before the student can get the visa. And the provinces are looking at, Ontario, for instance, has looked at all the private colleges and said, you're not getting any allocations. So all the private public partnerships, you know, all the community colleges that partnered with private colleges and strip malls and, you know, and offering very substandard education, all that is gone pretty much. They can't get student visas anymore, and they certainly won't be able to get work permits. So there are some improvements, but honestly, like if you look at the number, is 6.2% down to 5% is not dramatic in terms of the number of temporary residents coming down. So I think the minister just said last week that he's going to be looking at reducing the students even further. I think even the Liberal government and leaders in the government are recognizing that there is an impact on housing.
Yeah, and you know, and it's, as you point out, it's what kind of immigration is it? You know, I mean, are there still any investor immigration programs that are strictly for the investor?
Not really. And this is a sad thing, because I do think that Canada needs to compete in this way. And I think, you know, one of the big criticisms that the Liberal government is facing right now is that, you know, we're not a productive society. We're not an innovative society. We don't have innovative businesses. There's no funding for this. There's no push for this. And what we are doing is adding a lot of civil servants. Like under the Trudeau government, I think they added 40%. And I'm not being partisan here. I criticize the Conservatives and I criticize the Liberals, but I'm just calling a spade a spade. And the reality is, you know, we've increased the public service by 40%. Where's the innovation agenda? So I think that's been missing. And I would like to see, as an immigration practitioner and as a person who looks at policy and thinks about what's good for Canada, I would like to see a lot more aggressive implementation of investor and entrepreneur programs, right? I do think investors have a lot to offer. They bring wealth, and oftentimes they're entrepreneurs, they're serial entrepreneurs anyway. The Ontario government just killed their entrepreneur program. Each of the provinces run entrepreneur programs. Some of the criteria can be a little too obtuse, a little too narrow. And that's what they found in Ontario. So they need to get with it. And really, if they're going to kill a program without notice, by the way, you know, after people like me and others travel the world marketing it for them, I think that they should give notice before they end programs, number one. And number two, they should come up with a tweak, you know, right away and implement it right away, because people are really interested in coming to Canada and starting businesses and employing Canadians. And so there's only a benefit for them.
Well, and that was the whole idea of the old programs, was that you had to make an investment, you had to have one or two employees, you actually were contributing something. And as you point out, a lot of the immigrants, I used to work in Asia, I worked in Taiwan, and there was a lot of advisors over there that really advised the wrong thing. You know, it was a business for them to But when I looked at the average person who's actually coming, they were generally family oriented. They're certainly education for their children oriented. You know, most of my Taiwanese friends, when you ask them how long do you go to school, they say 24. It's assumed a necessity that you have a good education, and if you had a little money, that would be the ideal immigrant. And yet, we then managed with different programs and different ideas to really, you know, put them off from the program, and it didn't work as well as it could. Well, now you mentioned the international student visa and all that. I mean, how can you, the governments collaborate to have a balanced approach to managing international student visas?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. I remember attending a meeting when I was national chair of the Bar Association, and we actually met with the advocacy group for immigration consultants. And we don't agree on much, but the one thing we did agree on is that we shouldn't have private colleges. So I think that that's something that, you know, we're gonna see, because all the provincial governments are squeezed in terms of their allocations, right? So they're only going to give those allocations to the universities and to the community colleges that, you know, without those that have partnerships with private colleges. So that's a positive development. I think that they also need to think carefully about the types of students we need, right? We're going to need personal support workers. We're going to need the healthcare workers. We're going to need to train people in the trades, you know, so we can build these beautiful homes, right? I think that we need more of a certain type of worker. The government will want to promote French. They're doing that in there with their, there's a very easy work permit I can get for French speakers. Permanent residents, the points drop dramatically under our express entry point system if you're in healthcare, if you're STEM, and if you speak French. So they may want to focus a bit on that. And again, that's not for purely economic reasons. That's just for reasons of, you know, Canada's history and bilingualism, et cetera.
Well, it is a difficult thing. There's no question, you know, that you have, there's an argument we make on all different sides. But you point out the main argument is we're an aging society. We're not as productive as we could be. There's all sorts of reasons why we're not really necessarily innovative or creative. We need immigration. I mean, I was an immigrant, you know, a long time ago, and I embraced the country and its values and all it stands for. And a lot of people around the world do. So just I want to bring you back to the entrepreneur kind of a side of things. Is there a startup visa for entrepreneurs?
There's a federal startup visa, yeah. So they don't have, what replaced the old federal entrepreneur program, which was the program you talked about, where the government had to verify that you had hired two Canadians. What the problem with that one is that the bureaucrats hated it. They hated having to learn about business, and they hated having to verify that they hired two Canadians and that the person was actively involved in the business. Show me your checkbook, show me your sign. Document. Mm. The bureaucrats just didn't know how to deal with that and didn't understand it. So they did get rid of that federal entrepreneur program. I mean, it's an issue for me, because the other thing to consider is there's $1 trillion worth of businesses that need to change to the next generation. And many people who came under those old entrepreneur programs, whether it's people in the Korean community or whatever, or people opening convenience stores. Yeah. I mean, those kids, oftentimes they grow up and they become doctors or lawyers or whatever, and they don't want to take over the business.
Right.
So we do need people to come in and take over some of those basic businesses, but also some other very successful businesses. So I think that the government needs an entrepreneur program. What we have federally is simply the startup visa. And the startup visa is very narrow, because it's only about those with innovative business ideas. So you need, typically we get a founder who's sitting somewhere in an accelerator somewhere around the world. They've got a great idea, maybe they don't have any cash. And then we partner them with someone who has also been in touch with us, or one of the partners we work with. And maybe they have particular expertise and money. So they have expertise in the area. Let's say it's a medical app. We might get a medical doctor who's got great expertise in the field of medicine, who's going to work with this founder sitting there who's developed this app idea. The medical doctor will provide some cash infusion. The founder will come, start the business, they'll have meetings virtually, and then eventually, you know, the doctor will come. And that's just one example. There's lots of different examples of all kinds of different businesses, but essentially—
It's quite a job to put them all together, you know, all these different—
It's a big job to put them together. They have to get along throughout the whole process. So it's a lot of work we're kind of doing, you know, you know, for the government, frankly, to try to make this program a success. And there's a balancing act, and there's ethical obligations too. We have to, you know, sign the proper agreement so that they waive confidentiality vis-a-vis each other. And we've got to indicate that we have to, you know, act in their best interests. But typically it's not us putting people together. It could be, separate business partners, or it could be the designated entities themselves may have a database of people that are interested in immigrating to Canada and have expertise and are just looking to partner with someone who's a founder. So that's the start of Visa. It takes a few years, it is a good program, but we do look for people who have innovative business ideas or some money that they can contribute to it as a co-founder or participant.
But obviously you need some real advice. I mean, there's just no way that any individual can steer themselves through the various levels of government. And what about where to put the business? Where in Canada? How do you decide?
Well, for the federal one, it doesn't matter where. That's the beauty of a federal program. But if it's the person's interested in a particular province, BC, Ontario, whatever, we would look at the entrepreneur program under the provincial nominee program. So each provincial government territory has, you know, their own immigration scheme, which is why, frankly, immigration is so complicated, because it's not just a federal system. There's shared immigration powers with the provinces, particularly with Quebec, who has greater powers than the other provinces. So it gets quite confusing because you're navigating so many different provinces and so many different, you know, and the provinces can change their programs, you know, without notice, right? So it gets confusing, but we would just sort of find out which provinces they're interested in settling in, and then we'd look at the criteria and look at their resume and kind of go from there.
Well, certainly years ago, Quebec, you know, always was dancing to its own tune. They would allow, whereas in the rest of Canada, the entrepreneur, the immigrant investor could put his cash only in certain designated things. Whereas in Quebec, they actually allowed them to make them almost near cash, which actually was preferred by the immigrants. So a lot of the immigrants went to Quebec, used the program, and then moved to Vancouver or somewhere else afterwards. So it didn't really do the job, but Quebec had the benefit of the cash. When I look around the world at all the programs that are out there at Canta, I mean, whether it's a country like Malta or Cyprus, so they all have adopted the golden visa, meaning that after a number of years, you buy a piece of real estate, and the requirements to some of them are not really that high. You don't even have to stay there. You can, X amount of months per year is good enough. Anyways, all of those things. And we seem to be our own enemy in terms of making it more difficult to get the right kind of people. I was at an event just 2 weeks ago where one of the major developers says, look, immigration, yes, but we absolutely need construction workers, and we have to stop being anti-trade. You know, it's almost like if you're an electrician, we don't want you. And he says, we have too many liberal arts programs, you know, in all areas. Well, that's his view. But the point is, there is a real need in the construction industry, in the health industry, as you pointed out. So it's never easy. And when you hear that, well, how do this news measure with the real numbers? We hear $1.2 million were coming, a million people were coming. Is that true?
There's 2.7 million temporary residents right now. So, I mean, it is true that the numbers of foreign workers and the number of students has gone up dramatically. I think we're on track for 1 million alone this year in terms of international students. So this is a massive change in the last several years that we've seen this huge increase. So yes, there's a great cash infusion to the educational systems. There's obviously these students are buying goods, they're buying food, they're buying different things. But at the end of the day, I mean, is it impacting housing in a negative way? And I think that's where the government is responding, saying, well, yes, they're essentially saying, they're conceding it is affecting it negatively, and this is why they're trying to reduce the number of international students. So, yeah,
that's the big question on every radio show and every newspaper. You know, how does immigration status of individuals like temporary residents or refugees, how does it impact their housing options and their rights in Canada with that kind of a visa?
Well, I mean, that's the other thing. I mean, there was a fairly draconian rule that came out, which they modified. So So you can actually buy a house on a work permit now. But initially, the initial version was that you couldn't. So if you have a valid work permit and you've got some time left on it, you can actually purchase real estate, which is great. But there are some restrictions for others, like visitors and other temporary residents. So I think it's on a case-by-case basis. We can look at the particular fact scenario and advise.
Well, and that, and like you pointed out earlier, you have to have professional advice. You have to have professionals, and we do have some bad actors in the world, both here and overseas, that give maybe sort of false hope to the person wanting to immigrate. And the whole idea about telling people, oh, it's easy to buy a house, it's really affordable, and all of those kind of things. How can we mitigate that? That kind of a bad actor telling.
I would say, I mean, ideally, believe it or not, a lot of our proposals, from the Canadian Bar Association and the Canadian Immigration Lawyer Association, people would be surprised, but oftentimes we're arguing to make things a bit simpler, or we're saying that this is misleading, and oftentimes the proposals we make are actually, to make the system less complicated and to make it so that they don't need to hire us, which many people would find odd, right? Because why are lawyers, immigration lawyers, trying to make it simpler? Aren't they interested in the work that comes out of complex things? But at the end of the day, I don't think we're worried about that. I mean, certainly our focus is not on that. It's more on, the reality of us being professionals and not business people, right? I mean, if we're business people, we're concerned about growing our business, and if we have shareholders, that's our responsibility to grow our business. But fortunately, lawyers are like doctors. We're not business people. We're professionals, and we've taken an oath to act in the best interests of our clients. And immigration is always going to be complicated. I remember talking to the operations side and the policy side in the department, and the operations folks are always trying to make it simple, 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 and the policy folks are like, "Sorry guys, but life's complicated. People are complicated. Situations are complicated. You have conjugal partners. You've got common law partners. You've got, married people. You've got which laws do we respect in which countries? Are they married? If they're married there, are they married here? Is there, there's so much complexity with just even that small little narrow area of just spousal sponsorship. So I always tell people, look, when it comes to filing my taxes, I took tax in law school, but I hire an accountant just because they and their team does it every day. So similarly, when people are able to do things on their own, I tell them, and I certainly don't pressure people to hire me or anyone else. But I think sometimes people, for legitimate reasons, maybe they're too busy. Like I remember in COVID, the government was making doctors apply on their own through a special portal that lawyers couldn't access, and we had to say to the government, I mean, these are doctors that are saving people's lives in COVID. Like, do you really want to? I mean, maybe it's just worth it for them to spend a few thousand dollars and farm it out. And why can't people have that right to do it? Right to counsel, just something we talk a lot about these days, access to counsel. So I think, the government, unfortunately, because we're lumped in with immigration consultants, we have about 2,000 immigration lawyers and about 13,000 immigration consultants. Because there's just the volume of complaints is massive against immigration consultants, by the way. And because of that, we're the baby being thrown out with the bathwater. So the government has messaging around, you don't need a lawyer. Sorry, you don't need a representative. They try to put stuff online, but they themselves don't seem to recognize how complex things are. Even though former ministers have actually, singled us out and said, oh, this group of lawyers, they really know what they're doing. Or someone's asked the minister a question. Minister says, well, I don't know the answer to that. I'm just the minister of immigration. This is a technical thing. Please speak to those lawyers. So on some level, they get it. They get that it's complicated, but on another level, the messaging is poor, and I think it's in response to, frankly, the poor service people get from consultants.
Well, and listen, all legal things are getting difficult. Taxation, you need a tax accountant and a tax lawyer nowadays. And then the government keeps changing the rules continuously. In British Columbia, we have new taxes almost every week that and sometimes they're being repealed just on the same day as they've been announced, because everybody, it's an election year, there's all these other issues out there, but there is no doubt in my mind that we need immigrants. Preferably, and depending on who you argue with, you want the right kind of immigrants. If that is in your business, in your healthcare business, you want more health care professionals and you want to make easier access. What I found when I worked in Asia was sometimes it's the applicant themselves that don't want a lawyer. They don't like to pay fees. They don't mind paying a huge commission in a deal, you know, because their mindset is, you know, it's a deal and that's part of the transaction. But to actually hire a lawyer, you know, I used to always tell them, you know, spend 2 hours with her, understand what you're getting into, because just by going there quickly and your uncle or a friend, there was always a relative that could figure things out, and they get into huge trouble buying real estate in the wrong area is one thing, but buying it under maybe the wrong kind of an entity, rather inside a legal company and so on. So anyways, the sheer numbers of the immigration, you know, I mean, they are incredible. Are they worrying you to some extent?
I do worry, because I worry that, you know, it's breaking the consensus of immigration being a positive force in Canada. There's more anti-immigrant sort of backlash that we're seeing. I think that, you know, there have been some unfortunate moves in terms of, you know, Canada is a pretty isolated country, right? I mean, it's hard for refugees to get to us because we have massive fines on airlines, et cetera. So I think, you know, for instance, the Mexico visa, the government, when they came in power, the Trudeau government lifted the visa from, you know, they lifted that visa, and then we saw the refugee claim numbers going up and up and up. So I think a lot of people, you know, may feel that this is a government that didn't control that properly, right? I mean, now they have imposed the visa again, but after so many Mexicans have made a refugee claim, that the backlog at the Immigration Refugee Board is huge. Yeah. So I think that some of those things they should have probably dealt with a little earlier. And I think the solution was one actually I put on my LinkedIn account. I propose that they offer an electronic travel authorization, which we have for Germans, which we have for Brits, which we have for Europeans, provided they have a US visa in the past. I've been to Canada with a visa in the past or have a valid US visa. We do that for a certain small number of countries, and that's exactly what the government ended up adopting. So they could have looked at that years ago and done that. And so they were a little slow on that. Obviously, they didn't keep track of the number of international students coming in. They were drunk on the reality of a $22 or $23 billion infusion into the economy. And they weren't thinking about any effects, the effects on the students and the effects on the housing market. So that's something that has been quite unfortunate. Yeah. And again, like, I think they were a little bit too liberal with respect to the open work permits. Students were able to bring in their spouses, but you had open advertising in India saying, if your child is here on a study permit, marry mine for a fee so that mine can come on a work permit. So that was open advertising, just outright fraud. Yeah. So now they've eliminated that. So if you're now, and it's sad, because what about the legitimate students who are coming to study at a community college and they're married and the legitimate spouse should be able to come? So I think some of that, they didn't do a very good job of dealing with the fraud in the first place. And again, because they didn't deal with the people who are representing them properly, and they let them, you know, they let them do whatever they wanted, essentially. And so that's my biggest criticism of the government.
Well, you know, I just want to just briefly go back to the refugees being able to, what are their housing rights and options? I think you touched on the temporary residence, but what are the rights of a refugee? Are they allowed to buy
a refugee is someone, a refugee, well, there's, first of all, there's the claimant, right? So a refugee claimant, they make a refugee claim, they can get interim federal health, so they can get special health care through the federal government. They can then get a work permit. And then what happens is, by filing a refugee claim, it automatically triggers a removal order against them. So if they withdraw the refugee claim, then they have a removal order. If they, and they can't buy housing. If they, you know, don't withdraw it but are denied, then the removal order comes into effect. If they're accepted as a refugee, then they're able to take a second step, which is to apply for permanent residence. And then as a permanent resident, of course, they can buy real estate.
Interesting. Well, again, the proof positive that we need a lawyer. Now, I also hear you have, say, particularly in Germany now, we hear that a long time when I immigrated from Germany, and I said to the immigration officer, can I have both citizenships? And no. And then they said, well, could I maybe revert to it back later on? And he said, in Germany, he said, you know, we do not change our citizenship like a shirt. So in other words, he was quite a clear no, but it's a long time ago. Now I hear that Germany is actually allowing dual citizenship. Is that a fact or the planning?
No, they are. I mean, it's a fact. I mean, there's also, I mean, people ask me mostly about the U.S. and Canada. They think that if they become a Canadian, they have to give up their American citizenship. And the answer is no. India is a country where you do have to give up Indian citizenship to become Canadian. So some people have property or they have political ties or whatever, and they don't want to give up Indian citizenship, so they remain as permanent residents. So each country is a bit different. I would just say when it comes to acquiring Canadian citizenship, assuming your country that you're coming from allows you to keep their nationality, there's really no downside. And that's because we don't tax based on citizenship. Whereas becoming an American is something people should think twice about. Because even if you don't live in the United States, the long arm of Uncle Sam and the IRS will come after you, and they'll expect you to file tax returns, FBARs, which are identifying the highest amount in each of your accounts. Your registry accounts are not safe from them, and dual taxation is a real possibility, although there's a treaty between Canada and the United States. It doesn't necessarily cover it all. And remember that Uncle Sam, the Americans, government will be an heir. So when it comes to estate planning, it's problematic for estate planning. It's problematic for the need to file annually. It's and that, and you need to do that to be able to renew your passport. And it's also problematic from a, you know, from just simply a tax liability perspective. So there's a lot of negatives in terms of becoming a U.S. citizen from a tax perspective and estate planning perspective that do not exist when you become a Canadian.
Yeah, and certainly we have a lot of investors that went to the United States, and almost every state has different kind of entities that the CRA doesn't necessarily recognize. And dual taxation is a real possibility. So absolutely, you need legal advice. And we tell people all the time that, yeah, maybe a good deal, but maybe take a look at all the ins and outs. You know, we don't have triple LPs and some of the wonderful entities that they have down there. And in some cases, they're better or worse. But the key is it has to be accepted by the Canadian authority when it comes to taxes, or you're paying taxes here and there. Look, it was a really interesting, huge subject to handle in a short period of time. If people want to get a hold of you, can I put your contact information?
For sure. Yes, they can reach out anytime. It's just, they can just Google me. There's not too many of us that are immigration lawyers in here with my name. But you can see my photo on my website if you want. But yeah, it's ravi@janeimmigrationlaw.com. Anyone can reach out anytime. Ozzy, it was such a pleasure to have this conversation with you.
Well, thanks, so welcome. And the contact information will be, if you're watching it on video, will be below. And both the Ontario contact information, I will not put down his phone number because the man is a busy man, but you can certainly reach him through his website. If you're listening to this as a podcast, just send me a note, oz@jurok.com, and I will send you all the detailed information. Ravi, thank you so much for taking the time, making the time for us.